All right, I'd like to introduce the next and final speaker. That'd be me. So my name is Sean Conley. I'm a state soybean and small grain specialist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. But today I'm going to be talking about some of the work that I did in my previous career, if you will, is when I was at Purdue University. And what this was is kind of I don't really want to know if you want to call it a model or not, but one of the processes that we went through when soybean rust first came on the scene, and how as a group we got together and kind of looked at developing both educational programs and science-based research to answer some questions that we were getting from growers out in the field. I'd like to thank my co-authors on this, Greg Shaner, who was an extension plant pathologist at Purdue University and recently retired. Gail Rule, who works for the Plant Pest Diagnostic Lab, did a lot of the training out there in terms of first respondents, first detectors. Then Corey Gerber with the Crop Diagnostic Training Clinic at Purdue University. I also see that there's a pathologist in the audience, and I will again apologize for anything that an agronomist says related to plant pathology. There's a wise man in the back left-hand part of this, so according to Rankin, anytime you have an agronomist and a pathologist on stage, and the agronomist goes first, he comes in riding on the elephant, and the pathologist comes in scooping up everything that the elephant left behind. So that's according to Rankin. He was bringing us to that. So now, what I want to do is talk about, first of all, the need, and the hype might not be the best term on this, but the need obviously is in November of 2004, soybean rust was first identified down in Louisiana. I'm sure pathologists, anyone related to soybean, understands this. It was blown in. We've all heard the models and how this occurred. But what really kind of drove this is a lot of the growers, consultants, and others who had understood and been listening to the impact that soybean rust had in Brazil. I think that was the big driver. And some of the initial information, and I don't really want to call it misinformation because that's not accurate, because as we all know, we didn't know what this was going to do when it hit the states. And again, we have differential responses, as Bob can attribute to where you are, be it Georgia or Wisconsin or Indiana. And some of the early reports that we heard was it was a devastating disease, and it was what we saw in Brazil, that up to 50% or greater yield loss. And when these numbers start giving out, going out in DTN, going out in trade magazines, all of a sudden you get all the growers, industry, and everyone up in arms wondering, what is this going to happen? And then shortly after this, in 2005, I can't remember the exact date when this publication came out, but the USDA estimated anywhere from $640 to almost $1.4 billion of damages caused by soybean rust. So again, this is something that really drove interest among growers, among industry, among academia as well. So to kind of meet these needs, what we did is the Indiana Soybean Growers, or the Indiana Soybean Alliance now, Purdue University joined what we call the Rust Buster Team, if you will, okay? It was basically the industry. There was industry members at the table, the Indiana Soybean Alliance, which would be the checkoff board within the state of Indiana, as well as Purdue University. So the first thing we were able to do is really, and this is kind of the process that we went for, was develop a team. This is kind of how we went through and identified the team. First thing, and again, with how quickly this came out, the main thing we wanted to do is we really needed to quickly identify and assemble an effective team. And I can't stress effective team enough. First of all, we need to fit the need at hand. And this is where we started seeing some cross-departmental, cross-university, and some very interesting groups join up to really meet this need. And for the example, we had the agronomy, the botany, plant pathology department, ag econ, Ag Communications, the Soybean Alliance, and industry leaders, and they're all at the table at once. And I think that was an effective and a good way of looking at this, because all of them, if you would be the major players, were at that same table. Another thing that I think we want to remember is we're dealing with these emerging issues, and again, that's kind of the idea of the symposium, is that the people that are on this team have to work in a timely manner, all right? And again, I think one of the things we stressed in this is basically there is no room for these people that just want to join on a team and cash in some money, collect money, and just join a team. I mean, there really wasn't any room for people just to join and not do anything. I'd classify them as hanger-ons. You know, we all know them. If you're in academia or anything else, you all know those individuals that's trying to latch on and go on for the ride. So again, there's really no room for those. And again, there's also no room for people that couldn't make a short deadline, a quick turnaround. Because again, what we are dealing with is basically an emerging issue that people wanted answers to yesterday. And a lot of these answers we didn't know, and we were really looking forward to it. So again, working in a timely manner. Another one is you had to be able to check your ego at the door. We didn't have time for a turf war. I was fortunate with all the colleagues that I worked with at Purdue. There really was, and I'll explain why there wasn't an ego when I get down a little bit further into this or any room for a turf war. But I know at other institutions this came about. And I think that really set those institutions back that really worked in that you didn't really join an effective team. I think you just had different voices saying essentially the same thing, but unfortunately it wasn't one uniform or unified voice. And that's another thing I didn't put in this presentation. I think anytime you're working in emerging issues, you need to have a uniform voice come across from the university. Because if you have an agronomist say one thing, and then the pathologist come in right before him or right after him to say something else, basically makes both of you look poorly. And it really does not shed good light on the university or whatever team, you know, this may be coming through. I think the important thing is even though it is a team format, you need to sign one leader, okay? And in this case, obviously, it made a lot of sense that Dr. Greg Shaner, our extension plant pathologist, was identified as that team leader. And I think many of you probably know this, I know Bob probably does. Greg is an effective speaker. He commands respect, and he gets stuff done. And that's what you need in terms of an effective leader to be able to work on these emerging issues. Once we've actually identified this team, we've actually developed these work groups then, okay? And we'll kind of go through and talk about that in a little bit. What we did is basically set these objectives as a group. We got together on a table and sat down and set clear the table objectives. The first thing we wanted to do is to develop science-based educational materials. Okay, we wanted to make sure that what the information we were putting out was based on science. It wasn't based on, again, I don't want to use the term hype, but wasn't based on misinformation, all right? Because if it's coming out, it has to be the best information we have, and if we don't know the answer, that's a different story, all right? Next, develop science-based educational programs. Again, find the information and develop educational programs that would kind of meet the needs of our clientele. The next thing is as we're going through and identifying these weaknesses, first of all, we have to know what do we know, what don't we know, and this gets more people in trouble. I don't know, I actually have a lot of, again, I don't want to throw industry people under the bus, but I hear more people talk about Google Scholar and developing, getting literature searches through Google Scholar, and it's very effective, but if anybody, and I've been just as guilty as others of using Google Scholar, but you know there's an article out there. You just don't remember the name of it or who the author was, and you Google Scholar it, and you don't see it anywhere in there. So I think what I'm trying to say here is we really need to go into the literature and make sure we're finding all of the information, and not just kind of doing our general web-based knowledge transfer, if you will, just looking at Google Scholar. And once we identify our weaknesses, I think it's critical to initiate research to answer those questions, all right? And we'll talk about that in a little bit. And again, as we go through this process, I think it's important to revisit our objectives to make sure, you know, when we first start this process, we have our set of objectives. And then after we get through it a little bit, are those objectives still the best objectives out there, or can we change them, alter them, you know, really understand and look forward to make sure we're meeting, again, the needs of our clientele. In terms of educational materials, the first thing we did is basically put out the Plant Pest Diagnostic Laboratory, which had been, at that point, led by Gail Rule. We assigned as one website, okay? And I think that it's critical in any emerging issues that we assign one dedicated web page that contains all of the information, all right? So Gail Rule set up this Asian soybean rust webpage that all the information that came out from the USDA, from my lab, from Shaner's lab, from the Ag Econ Group, everybody, all of that went to one portal. Because I know how many of us out here have websites. Everybody has a website. So again, I think the critical thing is, and these emerging issues, that you can't be sending I can't be sending a grower to my website for agronomic information on rust, and then Shaner sending his to his website on diseases. I think for these critical issues, we need one dedicated web page or one portal. The next thing I think is someone has to be a champion of that web page. All right? It has to be timely updates. Things have to get posted timely. And if they're old or wrong, taken off. And it has to be basic current information, continuously updating this. Because again, we've all worked in web pages, and we've all probably had the same complaint or issue is that you don't update your web page, where the growers or the clients are going to do. Stop going to it. They're going to stop listening to it because it's not timely or provides good information. Now, this is just kind of give you an idea of, at least in Indiana, where we saw with rust. Again, this was initiated. This web page just started in 04. So again, it was found in November. This was up in the first week in December. So we had about 2,000 hits in December. Obviously, 2005 had the most web page hits. And then again, we see a decline in Indiana, for example, just because of the risk has dropped since that point. Okay. Another critical web page that was brought forward through the Plant Pest Diagnostic web page was the IPM pipe. And I'm not going to sit here. Many of you already understand pipe. Just to kind of give you an example, in the first year at 05, pretty sure, if I remember correctly, Greg had 30 sentinel plots out there. Again, been scouting, and I know there's been some movement for funds, and I believe, forgive me, correct me if I'm wrong, but in the 010, you all are still going to have funded sentinel plots in the south, correct? That funding is still going to exist? Okay, and I don't know where that funding is going in the north and maybe slowly retreating. Good. So kind of understand where we're sitting with that. But again, this is kind of a vehicle to give us an example. And those of you not familiar with the pipe network, again, this is just, I took this off on the 27th. All of the counties identified in red where there were positive finds. The counties identified in green is where they look for it, and they just weren't positive. Okay. Another example of things that we kind of developed in terms of educational materials, and I have a couple examples of this, and I'll pass them around here. For people to look at is basically this is the advantage I think of working with and again an emerging issue is getting your ag communications, getting the news media involved early. They're able to quickly put them on the team so your information becomes more of a priority in their minds, and they can quickly, once we develop the materials, develop a publication like this. And the interesting thing is it's kind of novel and it's how it's laid out. They had new ideas on how to basically make this publication, but I think they just give you the information. And again, as we all know, within our jobs, it's all marketing and getting our information out in a timely manner. And again, so having ag communications in the loop early. What we did with this publication, again, it's all-inclusive. It goes through the entire process. Scouting, identification, how to submit samples to the lab to determine or to identify whether it is soybean rust or not, pathogen biology, management, economics. I mean, everything a grower wanted was in this quick and dirty flip book. All right, it wasn't a 300-page novel. It was just quick and dirty, and I think that was kind of what the growers and the clientele were really looking for. At least that's what the soybean board said they were looking for with this. Initially, I would thank the Indiana Soybean Alliance. They funded this. They basically paid for 10,000 copies, so it was free to anybody in the state of Indiana to have this. Within less than a year, all 10,000 copies were distributed, sold out, and then from between. And then there's also been about 28,000 downloads of this off the web. The other aspect of things, again, we develop our educational materials, but as Joel was talking about earlier, especially when there's an emerging issue, growers like that face-to-face contact. And our administrator uses the term high touch. I don't know if websites are low touch. I don't really know. He just calls it high touch. All right? So what we set forward to doing with these, again, we're developing these regional meetings. And again, this was funded through the Indiana Soybean Alliance. They basically picked up the bill for all of us. Okay? So what we did is basically had six locations. And again, this was identified in November of 04. Starting on January 6th of 05, we had set up six programs across the state of Indiana where we focused on identification, management, and first detector training. Across those six locations, which fed in clients from Indiana, Illinois, and Ohio, we had over 1,000 clients come in and over those six locations. And based on the surveys, obviously there's some overlap there. Crop consultants managing 50,000 acres and a grower with 1,000. But based on the survey, this base impacted about 3.5 million acres of soybeans within the six meetings, okay? Then, during these meetings, a lot of other questions came up, and a lot of the questions came up related to spraying. How do you actually effectively spray soybeans for rust? So in that case, Corey Gerber with the Diagnostic Crop Training Clinic brought in Bob Klein, and many of you know Bob, he's here at this meeting, and he basically came in and focused on application technology. So he shipped the spray nozzles and everything out to Indiana. We had five other training sessions that were more hands-on, looking at, you know, the I don't want to call it really the physics, but the art, if you will, of spraying fungicides in soybean. Okay? Again, we had five locations for that and another 321 clients trained. Now, within Indiana, and I know Sean is probably getting familiar with this, they have this PARP system, Pesticide Applicator Recertification Program, that a grower has to go through. I don't know if this is in other states, but every 3 years, a grower that applies a pesticide has to come in and get retrained and get continuing education credits. All right? So during these PARP meetings, which was an additional 47 county meetings, there's another 2,000 clientele trained. So what we basically saw was within the first 4 months of this, we had over close to 3,500 clients, if you will, go through and become trained on rust, what we knew of it at that point, in terms of the damage, application technology, and management of it. Now, obviously, when we were looking at finding some of the loopholes, I don't want to say loopholes, but what we really didn't understand was beyond the research side of this. And again, we were looking at some fungicide timing and efficacy questions. And again, this was, again, led by the plant pathologists. And I think this ultimately became a lot of these, and I'll call them relatively uniform fungicide protocols that pathologists would pass around. The reason I call them relatively uniform is I know Paul Easker is handling these on the corn side of things. And about 75% of the protocols are the same, but there's a 25% that are all over the board that he's trying to figure out. Okay, I think they led into this and some of the plant health. Again, I'm talking from the north perspective. Again, in the south, they're still focusing on efficacy with rust because, again, as Bob was saying earlier, they actually had some significant yield loss from rust in Georgia in 09. One of the biggest questions that we had that was brought forward to us is, you know, what is the impact of soybean row spacing and application timing on fungicide efficacy and basically coverage? So both myself and Greg Shaner worked with the Indiana Soybean Alliance basically to fund some research where we used field scale applicators basically to go out. We put those spray cards out in the fields at different heights across the different row spacings and basically quantify what is the impact of, does row spacing have an impact on basically getting fungicides coverage in the middle and bottom of the canopy. And from the data, and this was published in 08 in Agronomy Journal, in short, row spacing had no effect at all on basically coverage. And again, where that importance was is initially when this came out, where all the growers saying, well, I've got a drill, I got a 15, do I need to sell my equipment and go all 30s to get better coverage? And again, but that was some information that really wasn't out there that research, we're able to answer that question and say, well, really, there's no difference. So stick with what you got, and you'll be just fine. The other thing, and actually what we had, this was actually driven by a local industry. There's a big aerial applicator in northern Indiana that was trying to figure out, you know, if there's 5 million acres of soybeans in Indiana, there's no way all of these spray coops are going to get across. Okay, they're going to be a big reliance on aerial applicators. Well, again, with aerial applicators, and given the labels at that time, which were 5 or 2 gallons, again, that he couldn't really see how the aerial applicators would be able to get across all of this land. So he worked with both Greg and I and testing some of his electrostatic technology, basically looking at, and it would be a significant investment for him. I believe it would be for every plane an extra $100,000 to put on this electrostatic technology on his planes, which would basically allow him to spray at 1 gallon per acre. So he's wondering, A, should I do this? And if I do, what is the efficacy on that? So again, we worked with this grower, he's a grower and an aerial applicator. And what we found was these electrostatics. And again, we did some work with dyes and other things, but the best work that we found were in some of these looking at the fungicide efficacy in seed corn. Basically, obviously, seed corn gets sprayed with the fungicide. It's a lot of the parents are highly susceptible. So we were looking at the efficacy of fungicides on these parents. And what we found really was no differences between the conventional at 5 gallons per acre, which was the labeled rate at the time when we were doing this, and 1 gallon per acre. So the efficacy was the same. So again, I know he's working behind the scenes and trying to get a label himself for 1 gallon electrostatic. I don't know where he's sitting at with that at this point. And I guess in conclusion, I want to talk about the end result. And the first thing is no soybean rust has ever been detected in Indiana, the required management. Now, that has absolutely nothing to do with the educational programs that we put forward, obviously. But it's kind of, just want to point that out forward. I think what we did see is we basically trained over 1,000 first detectors within the first 4 months of this coming into play. We trained over 3,500 clients in terms of what is out there, what we know, what we don't know. We developed an information delivery device, the websites, as well as the other publications that we put forward. We identified research questions that we didn't know and did know and put them in information for our clientele. And lastly, I think what we came up with, we had complete industry and university buy-in at all levels. And I think that was kind of an effective model with this. Again, and within the state at least, Purdue University was identified as a leader in this area for just getting the information out. Now, that's kind of some of the information that we were dealing with. And, you know, when you put this abstract together in May, that's kind of an emerging issue. Well, we have a new emerging issue that we're dealing with right now. And it's basically this extension response, which is dealing with a wet grain and delayed harvest. I'm sure many of you all are seeing this in other states. We have a team format at the University of Wisconsin. Okay, so it's driven by these teams, if you will. So we have this, what would be the team grains, and Mike Rankin in the back is a member of this. And under this team format, what we do is identify these issues and, again, try to have a rapid response. So as of last week, we had a teleconference. It has probably started about 2 weeks ago in our annual conference that this is an issue. We saw it coming down the pipeline. So within a week, this web page was developed and posted. New information was posted on this website. And Friday morning at 8 a.m., we're going to have a teleconference, a Wisline web-based teleconference. Right now, last I had heard, we had 55 individual sites. So it'd be counties hosting programs for us to develop and deliver educational materials on this wet grain. The biggest issues are going to be mycotoxins on corn. So again, I just threw this in here because this is actually a emerging issue that we're dealing with right now, and trying to get this information and accurate information out to our growers in terms of how to deal with it, storage, and if you think you have a mycotoxin problem, where to send samples to. So again, I just threw this in at the end because this is actually an emerging issue that we're dealing with right now, trying to develop our programs for Friday morning. So I guess with that, I'm going to stop. I'm going to ask if there's any questions, not only for me, but for other speakers in the audience.
Any philosophy on why the soybean rust hasn't devastated the U.S. like it did Brazil?
This is where it's nice to have a pathologist in here that can tell the accurate answer instead of the elephant answer.
I think it's clearly not. And the fact that we have in the United States, except for maybe in Florida, Texas, and Louisiana, we have rust-free periods where they don't have that in Brazil. And so we have an epidemic every year, but ours requires a vehicle like a storm to really move it to get it going fast. Brazil, they have no rust-free periods, and so I think that's clear. I think the latest estimate is the possible looking at 1 out of 5 years, something like that, that the conditions could be favorable enough as you might potentially see. But it all comes down to low score, an occupant early in the season that doesn't build up fast enough, except for the southeast and the mid-south. Say now our growers, after hearing all that you all have done, our growers have four comments. They want to know what to spray, they want to know when to spray, they want to know what the risk of if they don't spray is, and they want to tell when a resistant varieties out there. And other than that, those four things, they don't want to hear anything about soybeans. Because they're going to react. All our very, I would say 90% of our acres were sprayed for soybean rust this year. But all they want me to do is tell them when and what. And what if they don't? I think a big difference too is in Georgia, southeast, we're so used to most of our soybean growers are also peanut growers. So they're spraying fungicides, no big deal.
You had a big leg up, for instance, compared to Jared Headblight in the northern plains.
You've got to convince people to spray, or they're worried about it. For us, they've got the equipment, they're using the same equipment to spray soybeans as they do with peanuts. And so
we've been on our knees in front of the growers saying, now this is why we want you to spray.
Peanuts prepared us for anything.
Anything else? Well, I'd like to thank all the speakers for coming today and enjoy the rest of the meeting. So thank you all.